How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me,
the genes of you and me,
we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA. We're all made of DNA.
Hi, you're listening to DNA Today, a multi-award-winning podcast and radio show where we discover new advances in the world of genetics. From genetic technology like CRISPR to rare diseases to new research, for over a decade, DNA Today has brought you the voices of leaders in genetics in over 200 episodes. For the past 3 years, DNA Today has won the People's Choice Best Science and Medicine Podcast Award. I'm Kira Dineen. I'm a certified genetic counselor and your host. Returning to the show is Dr. Patrick Short, the CEO and co-founder of the health tech platform Sano Genetics. He has experience in researching large-scale genomic sequencing and rare disorders, and it is Rare Disease Month, so we do have to, you know, honor that. So happy Rare Disease Month. For people that are longtime listeners, Dr. Short was previously on the show back in 2019, so 5 years ago. I can't believe it's been 5 years. That was episode 109, wow, where we chatted about the genetics of autism, which I feel like maybe that's something we need to revisit in the near future because five years, probably a lot has changed. Yes. But today we are talking about the genetics of ALS. So welcome back, Dr. Short. Thank you so much for coming back on. You're always just lovely to chat with.
It's great to be here. Yeah, I would say the same about you. And I'm a longtime listener of your podcast as well. So it's always great to be able to be an active participant in it. But I love to listen as well. You've got such an amazing cast of characters. I'm honored to be part of it.
Well, ditto back to you because you host the Genetics Podcast. And I can't remember what episode I was on, but I've been on that show as well. So, you know, we bounce around. We pop on each other's shows, which is very fun. But yeah, so we're going to be talking about the genetics of ALS. I figure I should probably start with just how much do we even know about the genetics of ALS? Are there other non-genetic factors we've identified that play a role? Like, what do we know about risk factors?
Yeah, great, great question. So I'll also start this by saying my background is in population genomics, rare disease genetics. I'm not an ALS doctor. I'm not an ALS specialist. We've done a lot of work over the last couple of years in ALS. But the lens that I want to take on this is not just the focus on ALS, but also what we can learn about broader rare disease genetics from this case. So for those who are ALS experts, listen, if I get some of the details a little bit off, then please forgive me. Hopefully the perspective I can bring from some of the other diseases that I've worked in makes up for that. But for those who aren't familiar, ALS is a neurodegenerative disease. Depending where you live, you also may know it as motor neuron disease or MND. And it's a progressive and in many cases rapidly fatal disease. And one of the things that makes it challenging, like a lot of diseases that your listeners will be familiar with, is that it comes in both sporadic and familial and genetic forms. I think it's really important to distinguish those concepts because for a long time, actually in the field, it was familial ALS and sporadic ALS, meaning it ran in my family. And I know my mother was affected by it or my aunt was, and then sporadic, meaning it's just shown up. But really those aren't complete concepts because people who are sporadic can be genetic and people who are familial can be genetic. And so over the last couple of years, there's been a lot of unpicking of what do we mean from a terminology perspective, but there's some heavy hitter genes, really important ones, including SOD1, which is typically point mutations, and C9, ORF72, which is a repeat expansion. In different parts of the world, these are at different frequencies, but in Europeans, for example, European ancestry people, C9, ORF72 expansions are one of the most common forms. SOD1 is one of the most common forms. SOD1 was one of the first, I believe, actually the first discovered genetic risk factor of ALS. And for a long time, there's very little known about the genetics of disease of ALS. But over the last couple of decades, as with most common and rare complex diseases, the literature has been building and building. And today, estimates range between 10 and 15% of ALS cases having a clear genetic driver, but there's discussions we could have about penetrance. Not all of the genes and variants are completely penetrant, but that's the rough, I suppose, genetic architecture of the disease.
Yeah, and I think you said it well. Of just we're redefining a lot of these terms and, you know, like sporadic, but you can have sporadic where nobody in the family has it, but then we have a genetic factor we've identified that have, you know, led to that. Are the genes that you mentioned, SOD1, the C1 you mentioned, yes. So are those like, kind of like BRCA is to breast cancer where it elevates your risk, or is it like a prediction, like you will have ALS in your lifetime?
Yeah, so depending, if we take SOD1 as an example, some of the variants are very high penetrance. So having the gene there's near certainty that you'll develop the disease. And this is one of the, you know, examples I think to dive into that's particularly challenging from a genetic testing, counseling perspective, because people go through traumatic experiences where they have watched a family member die of the disease, that family members tested and they carry one of these highly penetrant, fast progressing variants. And then you have a decision, obviously, to make about whether you get tested, whether you get family members, children tested, so on. The C9 ORF72 expansion is really different, actually. So it drives risk of both ALS, but also FTD, frontotemporal dementia. And it is, most of the literature suggests that it's incompletely penetrant. And some of the recent literature suggests very much so, maybe even 25% penetrant. So it's still a massively elevated risk because it's quite rare, and the repeat lengths can vary as well. So generally speaking, the longer the repeat expansion, the more early onset and severe disease can be. But I haven't gone into the 40 or so other associated genes that have different levels of penetrance and expressivity. But it is a pretty complicated picture, which makes, you know, which like most diseases makes having these discussions difficult, because depending on the result, the next steps for a patient would be really different.
Yeah, definitely. Just depending on what their risk level is at that point, and, you know, what is their personal experience too? Did they grow up where they had a parent that they did inherit this genetic change from that was experiencing symptoms of ALS, and how long did they have symptoms for? And just kind of like how that personally impacted them, I'm sure is a really big part of someone's experience of getting that genetic testing. You mentioned like some other conditions, but how does it compare to, say, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's disease? Like, I think of like APOE is something that I think out of all of these genes that we've mentioned, if a layman's person knows one of them, it's APOE. And that might be because of Thor, sharing that, yes. You know, he has two copies of the E4 that elevates his risk. But Chris Hemsworth, not Chris. No, the other one.
I think it is.
Is it Chris? Right? Okay. Liam? Yes. Yes. Okay. Liam is Hunger Games. Chris is Thor.
Yes, that's right.
There we go. Very important. We got that right. How does it compare to like the other genes that play a role in the other types of neurodegenerative disorders? Like, are we further along? Not as far, because ALS is not as common, I would say, as Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. Correct me.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Way significantly rarer. I think, where are they different? Where are they similar? So there are some, if we take SOD1 ALS as an example, where it's, significantly different and probably more challenging in many regards than APOE4 or LRRK2 is the penetrance of the gene is much higher. So APOE4 elevates risk significantly, but there are many SOD1 variants that are nearly completely penetrant, and the age of onset is, can be 40s, 50s, quite young, maybe into 60s, depending on the variant. The progression can be as quick from first symptoms as 18 months from first symptoms to death, or even shorter in some cases. To some of the SOD1 variants are slower progressors, 10-20 years. And so the variability, the age of onset with something like APOE4, you're not really looking at elevated risk, I think, until much later in life. Whereas here you're looking at elevated risk potentially in, you know, what many would consider kind of the prime of your life. I think the other, maybe on the other side, there has been recently some pretty significant positive developments where there's been a drug approved by, Biogen developed a treatment for SOD1 ALS. And unlike LRRK2 or APOE4 that don't have yet approved genetically targeted medicines, there is now, I think, more hope and a better option for people who do test positive and have symptoms. One of the areas that I'm most excited about in ALS neurodegeneration in particular is how we pave the way towards earlier prediction and prevention and treating people who are genetic carriers, but not yet symptomatic or early symptomatic. And I think what we'll see in most diseases is drugs will get approved in people who are symptomatic first. And I think we'll see this in Alzheimer's, we'll see this in LRRK2, Parkinson's, GBA Parkinson's, but that should hopefully pave the way for the next generation of trials that say, okay, we've proven this can delay progression or halt progression. But what if we actually treated people 2 years before symptoms start? And one of the things that ALS does have that is, I think, another ray of hope is there's a great biomarker called neurofilament light that there's been extensive research. There's a researcher out of Miami called Dr. Michael Benatar, who's been working with gene carriers for many years to study the basically phenoconversion, where you go from not having any symptoms to starting to have symptoms to ultimately developing ALS. And there's a really good biomarker that shows up in the brain, in the blood, a year or two before symptoms really start. And there's a trial that's being run right now, actually, also by Biogen, focused on SOD1 carriers who aren't symptomatic yet. So, and we don't see anything like this in Parkinson's or Alzheimer's yet, to my knowledge. But I hope this can be a blueprint for the rest of neurodegenerative disease and genetic diseases in general, of how can we actually use genetics plus other more predictive biomarkers to identify and treat early rather than waiting until people are sick. And, there's frankly very, very much less, I think, that we should expect to be able to do from an intervention perspective if a lot of the damage has already been done.
Yeah, the prevention is so key, that if we can start treatment maybe even before the biomarkers, but if that's kind of what our approach is now, of like, oh, we're seeing biomarkers in the blood that, okay, this symptoms are starting to develop, even if someone is not exhibiting that, I guess, if there are signs that the disease is starting to progress and begin, then prevention is always going to be better than treatment. So if we can do that, that's like such a hope in the community, I think, especially for people that have had this in their family and they're thinking, is this something that I'm going to develop? What is the standard treatment? Like, we've talked about kind of the gene targeted, like what's been approved. And I think there was one that was, and maybe it was the one you mentioned that was recently approved. I was one of the other shows I produced called It Happened to Me. And our most popular episode last year was with an ALS advocate who has blown up online. Her name is Brooke Ebby. She was interviewed by like Good Morning America. And that's episode 16. I'll put it in the show notes for people for that podcast. But I remember she was talking about like a drug that like was like pending FDA approval or something here in the US. I know you're UK based, but you're from the US, so I know you still have roots here. What does treatment look like now that's standard if someone does not have a genetic change? And like what is kind of in development too?
Yes. The caveat that I'll make here is that this is going to vary pretty dramatically by geography, individual circumstances, but there has actually been an approved treatment since I think 1995. There's a drug called Riluzole that has very modest effect, but it's safe and it has been shown to be effective. So I think the vast majority of patients would be on Riluzole once they're symptomatic. I think depending on the doctor that you spoke to, you'd get really different opinions actually of whether you should prescribe Riluzole for somebody who's one of these pre-symptomatic gene carriers. And this is a big focal point for some of the patient advocates that we work with and that I think have been doing a lot of really good work. There's two people in particular, Gene Swidler and Daniel Barvin, who co-founded a patient advocacy group called End the Legacy, that they're focused around really this pre-symptomatic gene carrier group and what can the field do to better give them options to try to intervene upstream. And then the one that I mentioned that is the SOD1 gene carrier focus one is called tofersen, or I think that the marketing name is Qalsody, and that's the Biogen drug. And that one is going to be only for people with SOD1 ALS. But I think it's probably going to be up to the discretion of doctors whether they make the decision to prescribe it pre-symptomatically, post-symptomatically. And, that's something that I would suspect doctors will be monitoring the neurofilament light, this biomarker, very closely to determine, is there an, they've got a balance between dosing someone with something that could have side effects and could, you know, and could have a safety implication too early for, you know, for no reason versus waiting too late where the effect might not, you know, where it might be too late to have the maximal desired effect. But I think a lot of that's going to have to be worked out in not just clinical trials, but also the real world, real world studies where we see how these things actually work.
And I would think guidelines too, like in the cancer world, which I don't work in, but, you know, was trained in, like there are things, at least in the US, called the NCCN, National Cancer Comprehensive Network. So they provide, like, here's the guidelines of what we recommend. And especially genetic counselors are looking at like the testing and, you know, what's going to be, you know, recommended. Like someone had ovarian cancer, like they should be offered genetic testing. Is there something like that in terms of like ALS and, you know, guidelines? Because you mentioned like some doctors may say, oh, if you're like a carrier for one of these genetic changes, that's very high chance you're going to develop ALS. Like, let's start you on medication earlier. Or is it just, it's so new that we're just figuring it out, so there aren't set guidelines?
Yeah, there are definitely guidelines, but the extent to which they're universally agreed and followed, I think is questionable. We launched a genetic testing program called Light the Way, which is focused on both ALS patients as well as potential gene carriers. So it's also open to people who have a family history. It could be a close relative or relatively distant relative. We intentionally wanted it to be broad to enable people who are in this often overlooked population of the potential gene carriers to be able to take part. And one of the things that we found in doing the preparatory work for what gene panels should we select for this study is there's a huge variability of what patients receive. Some get only testing for C9 or 72 and SOD1 and maybe a couple of others, a very limited panel, whereas others get quite a comprehensive panel that includes 40, 50 genes, most of which are very rare, but will show up. We want to make sure that the panel is comprehensive and includes as many genes that are actionable as possible. You also don't want to go too far the other direction and include things where the evidence isn't really there and isn't supported. So there's a ClinGen working group that's focused around curating a gene list for ALS and FTD. And I think there's work as well to actually look at neurodegeneration more broadly, because there is overlap between ALS, dementia, frontotemporal dementia, even Parkinson's. There's shared risk across many of these, you know, the world of brain genetics. I think we're just still figuring out how this all cascades into different phenotypes. So in the UK, for example, there is a national scale genetic testing that's available. In the US, I think it's going to depend a lot on where you're seeing insurance coverage. So we found in the US, it's been a little bit spottier. The challenge in the UK is the testing is available, but the turnaround time is still pretty slow. As the testing service is ramping up, they're trying to work out how do we process hundreds of thousands of tests across the country. The UK is really world leading in genomic medicine, but that's coming with just the scaling challenges of how do we process this many whole genomes in such a short amount of time.
Yeah, I think that is, it's really just great that Sano is able to offer this. And from my understanding, it's a free program. So people that are doing this, you know, either you're eating the cost or whatever, your patients are not paying directly for this service. So when it comes to, and it's called Light the Way for people that might've missed that Dr. Short said that, for in general, when people are looking at doing this testing, and not necessarily through you, but just kind of like widening the scope a little bit, would you say most people are symptomatic and then looking for a genetic cause of their ALS, or the opposite, where there's some kind of indication, there's someone in the family and someone's like, I want to know if like I have a genetic risk? Obviously, this is going to just kind of like be what you've seen, but is it much more of one than the other? And I expect it to change where it's mostly going to be kind of preventative and prediction. But as of now, how do you see kind of that split, at least of like the people that you've talked to and been exposed to?
Yes, no, that's right. And yeah, to answer the first question about it is a free program. For the first 2 years of the project, we've had grant funding from the UK government from a great grant program called Innovate UK that companies like us can go to and propose ideas like this about developing technologies or services that the world needs. And we'll be looking at the end of the grant funded period to transition into a model where it's funded by health systems, pharma partners, the thought process being that patients need access to free and rapid testing to determine if they may be eligible for clinical trials, for approved therapies, and so on. So we're in the grant-funded phase of the project right now, and we've identified a couple of different problems that we're trying to tackle. So if we start with the symptomatic patients, depending on where they're seen, whether it's the UK or the US or Canada or anywhere in the world, the experience is highly variable. Some see the best specialist in the country and get comprehensive testing, great counseling, and they probably don't need our program very much. But more often than not, they may not have access to the best specialist. They may have even difficulty getting a referral to a specialist to begin with. So a big part of the platform is to try to help people bridge that gap between the standard and the gold standard, if you'd like to think of it that way. So that's pre and post test, telegenetic counseling, access to good educational materials through the platform, and so on. So that's for symptomatic patients, making sure that every symptomatic patient needs to get comprehensive genetic testing. That's the general view of the field. I should have mentioned this earlier, but this debate between sporadic and familial and genetic, the numbers are such that more of the sporadic cases, if you looked at the number of ALS cases that are genetic, more of them are going to be sporadic patients than familial, simply because there are more sporadic patients total. So if you said, well, we should only genetically test people who have a family history, you'd actually miss most of the genetic cases. So you need to test everybody is basically what the field has found.
Like population-based testing, where like someone like me that doesn't have ALS in my family, or there was a distant relative.
Yeah. No. I mean, anyone who shows up in a clinic with symptoms, has ALS symptoms, ought to get genetic testing, because the mistake that some made for years was to say, oh, if you don't have a family history, then genetics is really not relevant. And you probably get this in cancer and other fields, right? But actually so many more people show up as isolated sporadic case, or they don't know their family history. And then they do the genetic test and bang, there's something very relevant there. In some cases, not all, but so that's like, that's group one, the symptomatic individuals. By far the more challenging, the one where we had the more vigorous ethical discussions and how to do this correctly, is the people who are pre-symptomatic, or even we're struggling with terminology here because they may not become symptomatic. The potential gene carriers, and these would be people who would have a family member who died of ALS, whether they had or was affected by it, whether they've had genetic testing themselves or whether the family members had it or not. And we took the approach here to have, again, comprehensive pre-test and post-test genetic counseling, and participants can decide to exit the process at any point. We've also put together some educational videos with a ALS-focused genetic counselor named Lainey Dratch out of UPenn. And so people can watch these videos before their session, so they know. Sometimes people don't even know the right questions to ask, right? They go into the meeting and they wonder, what have I missed something that I should be asking in this time that I have with the counselor? The problem that we identified here is that most of these individuals just don't have any access to genetic testing at all, because it's not covered by insurance in most cases. Health systems like the UK, you may find a sympathetic neurologist that has the time and ability to work with you for the carrier testing, but more often than not, people are just not able to get access to it. So a research program is a good way to do this. And as a sub-study, we're looking directly at impacts on mental health and anxiety of the impact of testing. Because one of the questions we always ran into was this balance between not wanting to do harm. If you get if you get a genetic test result that you can't do anything about, but it's told you that you have, for example, high penetrance risk variant. But on the other hand, you may identify people who are candidates for this prevention trial and they didn't know it, and that could be life-changing in a positive way. And we were finding that there was not as much quantitative evidence on what is the impact of genetic testing in this population, for good or for bad. So and I should give a ton of credit to Dr. Paul Wicks, who's been really leading the charge on this from our side, and light the way is in many ways his brainchild. And he designed this sub-study to look at and try to quantify, it's called Beacon, is the sub-study, try to quantify the impact of genetic testing and bring some data to this question of when we test in a pre-symptomatic population, what is the impact for better or for worse? And how do we split that out by result? We suspect that people who get a negative result are probably going to feel differently than those who get a positive result. And we'll try to build on the literature that Robert Greene and others have done in Alzheimer's and disease where they've done return of results and looked at the impact in that case and try to see what the data looks like in ALS.
Yeah, it's very useful. And especially I think useful for people like me that are genetic counselors that may be people ordering this type of testing and then processing with patients because it's helpful for us to know like, what is that patient experience? Like, what do I need to be mindful of? For people that are listening that, you know, we have a lot of healthcare providers listen, right? So a lot of people that are kind of in our situation working in genetics in some way, but there also may be people that clicked on this episode because they have a family history of ALS and they're like, I want to know more about like where I'm at. So for people that are in kind of that, second category, what is the like inclusion criteria to be eligible to be part of the Light the Way program? Is it a certain degree relative that needs to have ALS? Do they need to be in the UK? Like what is kind of the criteria so that people know, oh, I could actually look into doing this and go to cenogenetics.com?
Yes. Yeah. The criteria is they have to have either an ALS diagnosis or a family member who's had an ALS diagnosis, but it is, you don't have to provide proof of that family member's diagnosis. We've kept it deliberately wide because we don't want to limit access to people for this. And it does not have to be an immediate family member. It can be a grandparent. It can be a aunt, uncle. It doesn't have to be a mother or father. So it's relatively wide criteria from that perspective. Obviously we'd ask that people who enroll in the study have this in their family. We don't want to just do the testing for people who are looking for it purely out of curiosity. It's live in the US right now, ethically approved and available, and it should be approved in the US within the next, or in the UK, sorry, within the next couple of weeks. We're hoping to do many more countries as well. So the grant funding covers us for starting in the US and UK, but we would really like to also hear from others around the world who think that something like this might be useful in their country, whether you're a nonprofit or a government health system or a pharma biotech partner, thinking about how you do clinical trial access, for example. We, in our research at the start of the project, we found that the US and UK have probably the best systems relative to their population size for this kind of testing, but there's still a lot of work to do. And for us, they're places we're used to operating and that we know we can make a difference, but we want to bring this program as many places as possible because there are many people around the world that don't have access to the gold standard that we think they should have for this kind of program.
Well, this is just such an awesome program. Thank you on behalf of the ALS community for offering free testing for people. Very exciting, US, UK, many others to follow. Thank you so much, Dr. Shore. It is just always such a pleasure to talk to you. And I like just get so into talking that I'm like, I don't even know what interview questions I was planning because I'm just so engaged with what you're sharing and just so much curiosity comes out of it. So thank you so much. And I really want people to check out your podcast, the Genetics Podcast. And I'm realizing we are doing a webinar together at the end of the month on February 26th. So for people that want to check that out, we will put a link in the show notes for that. Yes. Anything else to mention to people as we close out?
I just want to take a moment to say on this particular study, one of the things that it has, from my perspective, made it really successful so far is one of the things we did at the beginning was we created a scientific and patient advisory board. And so that board is chaired by Professor Amar Al-Chalabi, who's at King's College in London, and he's world-leading ALS neurologist and genetics researcher. The board also includes genetic counselors, patients, both those with ALS and those who are gene carriers who are pre-symptomatic, genetic counselors, ethicists. And we found that having that very diverse group of people together to talk through some of these really core principles of the biggest ones being how do we responsibly extend this testing to people who are not symptomatic today and may get a result from this that indicates they've got a high high likelihood of developing ALS. And I just thought that it would be impossible to run this kind of study without having that sort of collaborative group at the beginning. So I suppose the takeaway for the group would be, if you're thinking about doing something that's a little bit boundary pushing and different, we found that getting everybody in the room together, actually, we bottomed out a lot of these problems and found a lot. We found a lot of things that we thought there would be huge pushback on. Everyone was saying, actually, no, we really need to do this, and we'll find a way to do it correctly. But, you know, we were expecting a lot of doctors would say, there's, you know, it's potentially too harmful to do this kind of testing, right? There, the downsides of providing this with, when there may not be clinical trial options or treatment options, is too high. But, you know, many of the great doctors in the room said, actually, I think we need to do this and figure out how to do it responsibly. And of course, the patients and patient advocates said, we're living with this and it's our reality and we absolutely need to do something about it. So I just found it to be really productive to have that group together from the beginning and not, like many studies do, create it in a vacuum and then show it to patients and participants a year later and find out you made some critical design errors you could have bottomed out from the beginning.
That's really good advice, to have people involved from the beginning and from so many different viewpoints, from, you know, patients, people that may have the condition that are like carriers, as you described, genetic counselors, doctors, researchers, because they're all going to have their own viewpoint with it and their own insight. So I think that is wonderful for people to kind of keep in mind that are starting studies like this and programs. So awesome. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Short. I'm looking forward to our webinar in a couple of weeks. I believe we were talking about like newborn screening. Things along those lines. Yes.
Yes. Awesome. Very, very different, but in many ways related.
Yes.
Topic.
Yeah, very yes. much so. Just kind of like, you know, not quite population-based, but, you know, kind of almost in that realm. But thank yes. you so much, Dr. Short. This was wonderful.
My pleasure. Thank you. It's a pleasure as always.
For more information about today's episode, visit dnatoday.com, where you can also stream all 200 plus episodes of the show, including video versions of interviews recorded in 2021 or later. Any questions, episode ideas, guest pitches, or sponsor inquiries can be sent into info@dnatoday.com. Be sure to follow us on social media, especially so you don't miss a giveaway. We are at DNA Today Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, and more. Please rate and review the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. This truly helps us climb the charts and allow more genetic nerds like yourself to find the show. Here's a bonus. If you do and send us a screenshot, I'll give you a shout out on the show. DNA Today is created, hosted, and produced by myself, Kira Dineen. Our team includes communications lead, Corinne Merlino, video lead, Amanda Andrioli, outreach intern, Sonia Tanaker, social media intern, Kajal Patel, and graphic designer, Ashlyn Anokian. Thanks for listening, and join us next time to discover new advances in the world of genetics.
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, they're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.